Pasco County 911. What is the address of your emergency?
I'm in Pasco County, Florida. I'm standing beside Detective William Lindsay at the scene of a 2010 murder, just a short drive from the sheriff's office. The case I'm here for was committed by a couple, something that's incredibly rare. Criminologists estimate well under 1% of homicides are carried out by a couple acting as a team. It requires a rare and volatile mix, shared motive, shared opportunity, and a shared willingness to cross a line most people never approach. But that's why I'm in Florida. Because in this case, the sheriff's office has two tapes that I want. A confession from each half of the couple, recorded separately in different states within days of the murder.
This is July 20th, 2010. It is 10:06 in the morning. I am with Jason Andrews at the Hamilton County Jail in Chattanooga, Tennessee. It is May 26, 2010. At 14:46 hours, this is going to be a non-custodial interview, which is a homicide.
What's fascinating is that by hearing the accounts separately, without the other in the room, you get a clear picture of why they murdered together.
I need an officer.
Are you inside? Okay, are you inside, sir?
No, ma'am. I left the residence.
Sir?
I'm in fear of my life right now.
I'm James Buddy Day. This is Unmarked. On May 16th, 2010, the body of Dennis Abramson was found inside his home in Newport Richey, Florida, a coastal city north of Tampa. The victim's house is a nondescript bungalow in what looks like a quiet suburb. The murder took place in the front room. It's the same room I can see from the driveway. I'm standing in the exact spot the 911 call was made.
Pasco County 911, what is the address of your emergency?
The caller was a friend of the victim. He hadn't heard from Dennis in a few days and came to check in. Inside, the scene made it clear that whoever did this didn't take much time covering their tracks. Murder weapons were left in a laundry basket near the body, along with some of the killer's clothing. DNA matched a Marine Corps veteran named Jason Andrews, and a witness saw a woman inside the house on the night of the murder. She also was quickly identified as Amanda Logue. For weeks, this couple had been traveling around Florida using a variety of aliases before killing Dennis in the front room of his house. I reached out to both of them in prison, but only Amanda replied. In fact, I have her letter right here. It reads in full, "To whom it may concern, I'm not interested in doing any productions. They are used to hurt me and others like me. A dead end. But in this case, the sheriff's office has what I'm looking for." Not just one confession, but two. Two tapes recorded separately, revealing the dynamic between Amanda and Jason and the pressure points that eventually destroyed them. The first is an interview with Jason, recorded by Detective William Lindsay, who's escorting him from Tennessee to Florida during his extradition. So you have to imagine that when it's recorded, Jason is in custody. He's shackled and wearing prison scrubs.
I am with Jason Andrews at the Hamilton County Jail in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I am conducting an interview with him in regards to the murder of Dennis Abrahamson.
The second tape is also recorded by Detective Lindsay, but it's an interview with Amanda in her living room in Georgia.
It is May 26, 2010, at 14:46 hours. The interview is going to be taking place at the residence of Amanda Logue.
Okay, so everything's going to be recorded?
Yes.
Okay.
Amanda is sitting on her couch. Her husband is nearby, and at the time of the recording, she's yet to be charged.
Okay, I have a question. If I'm just the witness and I fully cooperate with you guys, will I face jail time?
There is no criminal charges in being filed in this case for you being a witness.
Amanda's question is why I want to hear these tapes. Because They're the most remarkable real-world example of something called the prisoner's dilemma. Imagine you've committed a crime with somebody else, someone you trust, a husband, wife, girlfriend, boyfriend, and you're caught. Detectives will separate you instantly, so there's no communication with your partner. Now, you're just two suspects in two different rooms, each facing the same three choices. The first choice is to trust your partner. If you both keep quiet, the evidence might not be strong enough to convict either of you. It's your best shot at walking away, but it only works if you completely trust your partner. Choice two, betray. If you confess and double-cross your partner, you probably get the better deal. And your partner, the loyal one, takes the full weight of the charges. But then there's door number three. You both betray each other. In this instance, you both might lose, but you also may limit the damage if your partner betrays you. So the dilemma becomes simple and devastating. Do you trust the person you committed the crime with, or do you try and save yourself? Most people claim they'd stay loyal, but once those doors close and the clock starts ticking and detectives apply pressure, the choice you make reveals exactly who you are. And as you'll hear, Amanda and Jason make very different choices. The best place to begin is 2008, when Amanda and Jason meet for the first time. Their relationship will last just 2 years. But in that short time, the choices they make will alter multiple lives forever. Amanda Logue is 26, a Southern girl from Leesburg, Georgia, born Amanda Bailey. She's a former cheerleader who lost her mother at 19, finding solace in drugs and alcohol. She's small, 5'6", a natural brunette turned platinum blonde. She's raising a 7-year-old daughter from her high school boyfriend, a relationship that ends in abuse.
Because I've been in an abusive relationship, not with my husband, but with my little girl's dad. I used to get my ass beat all the time. I'm 28. I don't take shit off of anybody. If you're going to whoop my ass, fine, but I'm going to let you know, you're going to know I was there.
When she meets Jason, Amanda is married to a former police officer named Lamon Logue. Amanda is the breadwinner in the family, earning money through modeling that turns into exotic dancing, then private fetish work, bondage shoots, and films. She often works in Chicago and New York, advertising on Craigslist for a, quote, massage appointment.
I do a lot of massages down there when I was there, and I also did a lot of modeling gigs.
Okay.
And so the days just kept getting, but anyway, y'all know, so.
Yeah.
This is when Amanda adopts the stage name Sunny Day, appearing in a handful of amateur and fetish productions. And she doesn't achieve any major fame. She's just another transient performer in the lower tiers of what is a very difficult industry. It's on one of these shoots in New York that she meets Jason Andrews for the first time. Jason was born on a military base in Germany. He served in the Marines himself. He's athletic, dark-haired, handsome. After leaving the military as a corporal, he has a contentious divorce and settles in Chicago, trying to rebuild. He takes the stage name DJ Veritas in the club scene and Addison in the adult industry. According to people who knew him, Jason loved to talk. He'd ramble about his military service, about his former life, most of it made up. In fact, many outlets still report that he was British, but he wasn't. At the time he met Amanda, he used a fake accent to create another version of himself.
Because I've heard so many lies from him about him being a lawyer and him being in the mafia, in the Jewish mafia is what he said. And that he could kill somebody with his fingers, bare fingers, blah, 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 because he was in special forces. He was a sniper in the Marines.
When Amanda and Jason meet, Jason is 27. And despite his flaws, they hit it off. Within a few months, they're traveling together, working together, sleeping together. And in 2010, Amanda's husband, Lamon, confronts the couple in a dramatic confrontation that ends with Jason pulling a gun and being arrested. Afterwards, he's banned from the Georgia county entirely and Amanda leaves her family with no goodbye. Jason and Amanda land in New York, working for a studio called Forbidden Gem. The studio is long since gone, but the movie they make is a parody of Oliver Stone's Natural Born Killers, in which Amanda and Jason play the titular couple on a killing spree. Now, I don't know if that planted the seed for what comes next, because at some point after filming that movie, Amanda and Jason relocate to Florida, and 6 weeks later, they commit a murder together.
Myself and Ms. Loeb had discussed having a victim, having her see someone in regards to like a massage appointment or what have you, and then killing and robbing that said person.
It's Amanda Logue who finds their target, Dennis Scooter Abramson. He's a big guy, dark hair and a goatee. He owns a tattoo shop and a repo business. He's connected to local motorcycle clubs and well-known to the sheriff's department, which is a short drive from his home, with past reports involving domestic violence. Amanda explains how she and Scooter first connected.
But we met on Craigslist, or I found him on Craigslist for a massage. It was $100 to come give him a massage for an hour.
Been to the house several times, correct?
2 to 3 times. I'm not exactly sure.
How many times did Jason go with you?
Each time.
She called him up or texted him, I can't remember exactly, I'm sure it's on the phone records, and suggested that she come over.
According to Amanda, when she goes to Scooter's house, Jason comes along as a sort of bodyguard.
He went with me to all my little gigs that I did, you know, because it's not safe, especially Craigslist, since crazies have been on Craigslist killing people and stuff.
This part of Amanda's tape is very telling. Quote, crazies have been killing people on Craigslist. It's a Freudian slip, and it reveals her position in the prisoner's dilemma. Remember, she has only 3 choices. Lie and trust that Jason lies too. Confess, trusting Jason to stay silent. Or tell the truth and hope for the best. Amanda chooses option 2. She shifts the blame towards Jason, betting that he'll stay loyal. But Jason, he chooses option 3. He confesses and hopes the truth will save him. From just a pure game theory perspective, Amanda makes the smart choice. But as you'll see, it backfires. Because at the time her interview is recorded, police already have the couple's text messages. Hundreds of them. In the days leading up to the murder, the couple text about their excitement, their plans, their details, when, how, and where to strike. So when Amanda sits down for her interview, investigators know the whole story, but they let her talk. On May 15th, 2010, the fantasy finally crosses into reality. Amanda arranges to meet Scooter for what looks like another massage appointment. She arrives around midnight, and Jason is hiding in the back seat of her white Ford Explorer, wearing mechanics gloves pulled over latex gloves. His intentions are obvious.
And I was laying down basically in the floorboards of the back seat of the vehicle.
They know the layout, they know the routine, they know exactly what needs to happen. What they don't know is how much evidence they're about to leave behind.
I then crossed the front of the house to the front door, which was still locked. I texted Ms. Lowe this information and then went and waited at the corner of the house.
Inside the house, Amanda has Scooter face down on a massage table that he keeps in the front room.
After the massage, he fell asleep like I told you he did, on the massage table.
At 3:27 a.m., Amanda texts Jason, knowing he's waiting outside. I can't read the messages verbatim, they're way too graphic. But to paraphrase this one, she says she's excited, that she can't wait, and suggests they have sex afterwards.
And we were texting back and forth. You know, I don't know what all we were texting. I'm sure y'all have the phone records. I've done my best to try to just block it all out.
And this is where her story shifts on the tape. In her interview, Amanda positions herself as being in the wrong place at the wrong time. She reiterates that Jason was only there as security and that she was surprised when he suddenly entered the house.
I believe he got out of the vehicle because he heard us in the back, you know, giggling, having fun. I didn't know what the hell he was going to do. I mean, when he came in the door, I was like, okay, maybe he's just going to rob him or something. I don't know.
This is the lie that takes Amanda down. She pushes her gambit just a little too far, trusting that Jason will protect her story. But Jason doesn't. Jason's tape shows that he doesn't trust her at all.
Did Amanda Logue know that you were coming in the residence to commit murder?
Yes, sir.
Was she an active, willing participant in the murder of Dennis Abraham?
Yes.
And Jason's version is backed up by their text messages. At 4:30 a.m., Amanda texts Jason, saying that she's about to hit Scooter with a bottle and render him unconscious. She tells Jason to wait. Now, this doesn't happen, but 3 minutes later, Amanda texts, quote, come in. And then minutes later, she texts, quote, it's open, referring to the front door.
At the point where you're given a massage or after you're done with the massage, did you send Jason a text telling him that the door was unlocked?
Well, he asked me if the door was unlocked, and I told him yes, the door was unlocked.
Listening to Amanda's tape, this is where she begins to cast herself as a passenger in Jason's plot. But it's clear she's the one setting the timing, guiding the moment, and messaging him the next steps.
So was Jason's intention to rob him?
I believe so. I don't believe... All right, let me put it to you this way. He went from being just the nicest guy to, well, let's just go rob somebody.
Amanda's entire interview is a negotiation with herself. It's a performance designed to soften her role, to distance herself from the violence, and to frame Jason as the unstable one.
He is a very jealous person, and he never hit me, but he would grab me. And he was really mentally abusive. It was like he was trying to brainwash me into leaving my family and just running away and becoming a ghost.
But the problem for Amanda is that the evidence doesn't just contradict her. It reveals exactly how she thinks. Not as an accomplice swept along by someone else's choices, but as a partner who believed she could control the story afterwards. Jason trusted the truth to save him, and Amanda trusted the lie.
Jason came in the front door and he saw Scooter, you know, going at my leg because he was laying on the table like this. And you know how big the table was. Okay, it was barely big enough for him. I'm massaging him like this, you know, massaging his head and his back.
Immediately after entering the home, I could see a straight shot back to the living room where Mr. Abrahamson was face down and she was there massaging him. She made eye contact with me. I subsequently removed my shoes and left them by the front door.
It's 4:30 a.m. In this moment, with Amanda looking directly at him, Jason retrieves the first of two murder weapons, a sledgehammer and a knife, both found inside the house.
I found the handheld sledgehammer. I really just can't remember which room it was.
On her tape, Amanda describes this moment as well, but I want you to listen to the way she frames it.
And the next thing I remember is Jason, he had something in his hand. He's left-handed. And it was like a big hammer thing.
It doesn't sound like much, but as she keeps describing the sledgehammer, Amanda keeps repeating one specific detail. Jason is left-handed.
He's left-handed.
And now he's got something in his hand, you said, in his left hand.
He's left-handed.
If you've listened to our other episodes, you might recognize this. It's a verbal anchor. A repeated, rehearsed detail designed to shape the narrative. Suspects use verbal anchors to appear consistent, to sound truthful, and to subtly nudge investigators toward a version of events that benefits them. By emphasizing Jason's left hand, Amanda is trying to paint a picture. Jason entered violently, weapon already in hand, acting on impulse, while she is the bystander caught in the blast radius. All she can do is relate the specifics of what she saw. But the problem is timing, because when Jason enters the house, Amanda doesn't stop her massage. Amanda doesn't react.
She was still massaging the victim, and I waited for what seemed like an eternity. Couldn't have been more than 30 seconds, probably, before I struck him.
Jason's version is clinical. This is what we did. This is what happened. Well, Amanda's version of this moment is violent, chaotic, dramatic, and it purposely distances her from the attack.
I backed away because I didn't know what was going to happen. And he started just bashing him in the back of the head. And I turned around, I freaked out, I almost threw up, and he told me to suck it up, you stupid bitch. You can handle this. And then he grabbed me by the back of my hair and made me see what he had done.
One of these accounts is a confession, one is a performance.
He made me watch him do this, and he said that he had done it before and that he had become a ghost plenty of times to where he could just disappear, and he would do that for me.
And the evidence shows us which is which.
I struck Mr. Abrahamson the first time very, very hard. Could feel a physical crushing of the back of his skull. The first blow I dealt him very well could have killed him, or it obviously knocked him completely unconscious.
The autopsy confirms what Jason says. Dennis Abramson was struck 15 to 20 times with a sledgehammer. And when police enter the home days later, the body is exactly where Jason left it, face down on the massage table.
After I was done striking Mr. Abramson, I just stood there and listened to the sounds of the blood dripping on the floor. And I just couldn't stop looking for, it was at least 5 minutes, if not 10, that I stood there.
And the autopsy reveals something else. Post-mortem stab wounds. 3 at the base of the neck, 1 in the right rib cage, 2 more down the back. This is the second weapon. A second moment of violence.
I'm told that there is apparently a second knife. I never saw this knife. I never held it. I never saw Amanda either, but apparently there are multiple additional stabbings that I was not personally aware of.
I don't know where the knife came from. I don't know where any of these things come from that he found.
This is remarkable. Two people who planned a murder together, one trying to minimize their role, the other taking responsibility, both now denying the same piece of evidence. But they're not just denying the knife. They're denying the intimacy of the violence, the close range, the deliberateness. The quiet decisions made after the chaos of the hammer blows. It's the part of the crime neither one of them can rationalize. The part neither one can fit into their version of events. The part that exposes what they actually became on that night. Jason denies what doesn't fit his narrative. Amanda denies what doesn't fit hers, and the stab wounds become the space between them. The one part of the murder that neither are able to claim, because neither wants to face the full truth of who they were in that room.
And I was like, dude, can we please get the hell out of here? I'm freaking out. I just went out to the truck.
By this point in their tapes, Amanda and Jason's accounts fracture even further. And each one is now trying to shape a version of events that leaves them with the smallest possible piece of responsibility.
Had there been any discussion between you and Jason about stealing anything from Scooter, any money, anything like that, any conversation prior to you going there or while you were there?
Yes, but I told him it was a bad idea.
She left at that point to go grab the truck, pull it up to the front door, matter 25, 30 feet. I loaded, the two baskets that contain computer, cameras, miscellaneous garbage, which I stacked onto one of the other baskets.
Scooter's house was a disaster, that there wasn't anything in there that, you know, was worth any. I mean, I'm sure there's stuff in there that was worth something, but nothing that we could use or anything.
By 5 a.m., the items are loaded, and they leave the house and head to a nearby gas station, where Jason says they dump key pieces of evidence.
Shortly after that, Amanda stated to me that she was certain that she had left in a basket on the kitchen floor her hoodie and the two murder weapons.
At this point, Jason knows it's only a matter of time until they're arrested. They still make a half-hearted attempt to cover their tracks. Less than 24 hours after the murder, Amanda posts on Twitter referencing Jason's handle, Here Veritas. She writes, quote, "Taking it easy with Here Veritas, laying around, eating popcorn, and watching movies." At 5:20 p.m. that same day, Andrews tweets, quote, "The real Sunny Day and I want to go watch a movie tonight. Any suggestion?" In reality, Amanda and Jason take all the valuables they've stolen from Scooter's house and do something else entirely.
And we immediately took that money and spent almost all of it on liquor and drugs. You know, get high. A day or not even 48 hours after that, Amanda was in the shower. I was watching the news quite avidly, checking the internet.
When Jason realizes authorities are describing his murder scene, the couple panics and take off. They avoid main highways, dumping more evidence along the way.
Then we packed everything into black trash bags and started just touring the area and dumping stuff at different places.
On May 18th, just 3 days after the murder, Amanda and Jason are flat broke, and they're arrested for stealing $67.97 worth of clothing from Beale's department store. They're booked into the county jail for shoplifting. But at this point, neither one has been identified as a suspect in the homicide. So Amanda's Explorer is impounded, but they're able to post bail and walk out. But it's this arrest that proves to be their downfall, because inside Amanda's truck, police find both her and Jason's Blackberries, and they're able to retrieve their text messages in their entirety. Jason is quickly located working as a manager at a high-end billiards and cigar lounge in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And Amanda? She is back home living in Georgia with her husband and 9-year-old daughter as if nothing has happened.
I did not murder this man. I had no intentions of this man ever getting murdered. I made money off of this guy. He was a money maker for me. If he was still alive, I would still be there making money off of him. And yes, Jason was more than likely there to rob him.
Both are indicted by a grand jury for first-degree murder. Jason pleads guilty and is sentenced to life without parole. Amanda accepts a plea deal, pleading to second-degree murder, and receives a 40-year sentence. In the end, the tapes of Amanda Logue and Jason Andrews remain one of the clearest, rawest examples I've ever seen of a killer couple confronted with the prisoner's dilemma. Two people who planned a murder together, carried it out together, and tried to escape together. But the moment they're separated, everything changes. Jason chose confession, Amanda chose denial. Both choose the version of the truth they thought would save them. These interviews aren't just statements, they're psychological x-rays. You can hear trust evaporating in real time. You can hear the fear, the calculation, the self-preservation. You can hear two people rewiring their story to survive. And that's what the prisoner's dilemma ultimately teaches us. Even when two people are bound by intimacy, by secrecy, by shared violence, loyalty lasts only until the cost becomes too high. When the door closes, when the tape starts rolling, and the stakes turn life and death, the partnership fractures, and each person retreats to the version of themselves that they can live with. Amanda and Jason entered the crime as a pair, but they face the consequences alone.
Anything else? Nope. Okay. I'm gonna stop the tape.
If you go to our social media channels, YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram, you'll see additional content about this episode. More phone calls, insights, interviews, and we'll be posting daily from the last decade of our true crime reporting. This season on Unmarked, you'll hear exclusive audio of interviews, calls, and content. We're opening our archives one case at a time. Subscribe to Unmarked so you don't miss what we reveal next, including members' portals with full case file and research. This episode of Unmarked is produced by John Nadeau and edited by Miranda White. Our additional producers are Jesse Demaray and Steve McClellan.